Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. I'm Bob, reading today from Charles Spurgeon's autobiography. We've come to another one of those two-chapter topics that I will try to squash into one, if you will please allow me to do that. We're talking about his visits to Mentone. We've talked about him a little bit before, but there was so much of that going on in his life for over 20 years that the authors felt it was important to tell you a little more about it. But I'll have to skim and skip a little bit. A lot of pictures, too, so it should go fairly quickly. He says, I do not think, this is Spurgeon himself, I do not think any human being upon earth ever felt so much repose of soul and body as I do. Many years of toil are all rewarded by this blessed rest, which only seems too good to be true. I have no task work. I do more voluntarily as a recreation than I have often done of obligation. No idle tongues disturb me, or cares molest me. The burden is taken from the shoulder and the bit from between the jaws. If anything can make me young and strong again, this will. It is rest of a sort which I never knew before in all its forms. For at other times, pain or dullness or too much company has made it less enjoyable. I rest on the wing, as the swallow is said to do. Well, the author, or the compilers of the autobiography, now continue the story. It would have been easy to fill a volume with the account of Mr. Spurgeon's experiences in the sunny South. Let me stop there and tell you about Mentone again, if you didn't hear this one. Mentone is a city on the French Riviera near the Italian border, and he would take an annual trip there from cold, damp, foggy London to get away from all of that and to rest from his labors for, I don't know exactly how long, but every season he was there, once a year. And he had gout, he had rheumatism, he had Bright's disease, he had so many things, and he had to go away and rest. So this is what was happening during those times. But the many other interesting portions of his wondrously full life make it needful to condense into two chapters, for us it'll be one, the record of about 20 annual visits to the Riviera. He was fairly familiar with most of the favorite resorts on that part of the Mediterranean shore, and he occasionally made a short stay at one or other of them, but Mentone was the place he loved beyond all the rest. Sometimes, after going elsewhere for a change of scene, a few days sufficed for the enjoyment of the beauties and charms of the new region, and then he would say, I think we will hasten on to Mentone. On settling down in his old quarters, he generally exclaimed, with a sigh of relief, Ah, now I feel at home. Mr. Spurgeon's first visit to the Riviera was made before the railway had been completed along the coast, and he used often to describe to his traveling companions in later days the delights of driving from Marseille to Genoa and so being able to see, under the most favorable conditions, some of the loveliest views on the face of the earth. On that journey, one incident occurred which was quite unique in the pastor's experience. While staying for a few days at Nice, he received a letter from the captain of the Alabama, an American man of war, lying in the harbor, inviting him to pay a visit to that vessel. Well, on accepting the invitation, a very pleasant time was spent on board, and then the captain asked Mr. Spurgeon to come another day and preach to his officers and men, and to those of a second man of war, which was stationed not far off. Though the preacher was out for a holiday, he gladly availed himself of the opportunity of conducting the service desired, and after it was over, he chatted for some time with a number of his sailor hearers. Amongst them, he found one who, when a boy, had been in Newington Sunday School, and whose uncle was a member of the Tabernacle, and another who, as a lad, ran away from his home at Dulwich. Several different nationalities were represented, and a good many Roman Catholics were there. But all seemed exceedingly pleased to listen to the gospel message And Mr. Spurgeon said that he did not know that he had ever enjoyed preaching more than he did on that occasion, and that he should ever afterwards reckon himself an honorary chaplain of the United States Navy. Well, tidings of that service probably reached other American vessels. For several years later, when the USS Trenton, the flagship of the European squadron, was at Gravesend, the chaplain wrote to Mr. Spurgeon, "Could it be possible for you, amid your abundant labors, to come down some day and address our officers and men? It would be esteemed a great favor, and I know it would be the means of doing incalculable good. All through the cruise, it has been my desire that the ship might go to some port in your vicinity, hoping thereby that you might oblige us with a visit." Well, the pastor was unable to accede to the request so kindly conveyed, but he fully appreciated the honor, and perhaps all the more because he was never invited to preach on board a British man of war. But one of the traveling companions on the first visit to the Riviera was the pastor's friend, deacon, and publisher, Mr. Joseph Passmore. He was usually a member of the little company who gathered at Mentone year by year, though latterly his partner, Mr. James Alabaster, had the joy of taking his turn at holiday-making with the author whose works he had so long published. In 1879, Mr. Harold, that's his secretary, went for the first time, and from that year until the never-to-be-forgotten last visit of 1891 and 92, he was only absent twice, when his services seemed more urgently required at home. Mr. Spurgeon often quoted one of Father Abraham's sayings, "I don't believe any other three men in Mentone have done as much work as we three have done today," he said. Now, the speaker's share of the work consisted in sitting quite still and reading the newspaper while the pastor did other things. It's already been intimated that the season of rest was by no means a time of idleness. Some friends even hinted that there was too much labor and too little relaxation. The quotations at the beginning of the present chapter give the chief worker's own view of the matter in 1882, and a few more extracts from his letters of the same period will furnish details of the manner in which some of his days of holiday were pleasantly and profitably spent. And I'm quoting from a letter. "I went up to Dr. Bennett's garden at 11 o'clock and remained there alone with Harold until 3:30. He read to me, and then I dictated to him, changing to a talk, a walk, a pun, some fun, and then reading and speechifying again, the electric shorthand bottling all up for future use. I did enjoy it, though the mistral blew savagely. We were in a corner of the kiosk, and out of all the wind, and yet in the open air, with mountains and seas, and garden all around, and no one disturbed us. It was the beau ideal, the perfect place of an artistic author's studio. Harold read to me yesterday the life of Cromwell, grand, soul-inspiring. How that man trusted in the Lord. How sweet is the life of faith, and how splendid are its triumphs." Mr. Spurgeon never saw a cyclamen growing anywhere without recalling an amusing incident which happened in Dr. Bennett's garden at the time when visitors were freely welcomed there in the morning. The pastor and his secretary had found a sheltered spot where they were completely hidden from view, and during one of the pauses in the reading or dictating, they were greatly interested in hearing a young lady, quite near them, exclaim in unmistakable transatlantic tones, "Oh, mother, do come here. There are some lovely, sickly men." Cyclamen, and just here. "I do love sickly men." Perhaps the speaker would not have been quite so enthusiastic if she had been aware of the proximity of the English listeners who mischievously gave to her words a meaning she never intended them to convey. Cyclamen being plant and sickly men, well, you know what that means. When Dr. Bennett restored the Saracenic Tower here represented, he placed it at the disposal of Mr. Spurgeon, who at once availed himself of such a delightful retreat. Perched up so high above the sea, the view all around was indescribably lovely, while by turning the key in the lock, absolute immunity from intruders was secured. So, I'm going to skip over a little bit here. Dr. Bennett's garden was not the only open-air study that Mr. Spurgeon had at Mentone. And they show you another place where he was want to stay. I'm going to have to move on. Occasionally, the time devoted to reading in the open air was spent in one of the many lovely valleys by which Mentone is surrounded. Mr. Spurgeon never forgot one experience which he had in the portion of the Gorbio Valley represented in the illustrations here. In this valley, he says, I have spent many a happy day just climbing to any terrace I preferred and sitting down to read. I once left Mentone on Psalm 99 by the roadside. I'm sorry, Psalm 119 by the roadside. And before the next morning, it was returned to me. And here, too, on Christmas Day, 1879, I learned what it is to walk in the light. Quote, I had been ill with gout, and on recovering, arranged to drive up this valley as far as the road would serve, and then send away the carriage, walk further on, have our lunch, and in the afternoon walk gently back to the spot where we left the conveyance, the man having orders to be there again by 3. But alas, I had forgotten that, as far as the upper portion of the valley is concerned, the sun was gone soon after 12. I found myself in the shade before lunch was over, and shade meant sharp frost. For wherever the sun had not shone, the earth was frozen hard as a rock. And to be caught in this cold would mean a long illness for me, and so, leaning on the shoulder of my faithful secretary, Mr. Harold, I set forth to hobble down the valley. The sun shone on me, and I could just move fast enough to keep his bright disk above the top of the hill. He seemed to be rolling downward, the sun did, along the gradually descending ridge, like a great wheel of fire, and I, painfully and laboriously stumbling along, still remained in his light. Of course, it was not the time for our Jehu to be at the appointed spot, and so, with many a groan, I had to stagger on until a stray conveyance came in our direction. Out of the sunshine, all is winter. In the sunlight, alone, is summer. Oh, that spiritually I could always walk in the light of God's countenance, as that day I managed to keep in the sun's rays. One of the charms of Mentone to Mr. Spurgeon was the fact that he could constantly see there illustrations of biblical scenes and manners and customs. He frequently said he had no desire to visit Palestine in its present forlorn condition, for he had before his eyes, in the Riviera, an almost exact representation of the Holy Land as it was in the days of our Lord. He was greatly interested in an article written by Dr. Macmillan upon this subject, in which that devoted student of nature traced many minute resemblances between the climate, the conformation of the country, the fauna and flora, and the habits of the people in the south of France of today, that day, and those of the East in the time when Jesus of Nazareth trod those holy fields. In several of his Sabbath afternoon communion addresses, the pastor alluded to the many things that continually reminded him of Emmanuel's land, while the olive trees were a never-failing source of interest and illustration. One of the works with which he had made very considerable progress was intended to be, if possible, an explanation of all the scriptural references to the olive. Mr. Spurgeon often remarked that there were many biblical allusions which could not be understood apart from their oriental associations. And as an instance, he said that some people had failed altogether to catch the meaning of Isaiah, I'll make it 57, Isaiah 57:20, where it says, the wicked are like the troubled sea, when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. Well, those who have affirmed that the sea never can rest have not seen the Mediterranean in its most placid mood, when for days or even weeks at a time there's scarcely a ripple upon its surface. During that calm period, all sorts of refuse accumulate along the shore. And then, when the time of tempest comes, anyone who walks by the side of the agitated waters can see that they do cast up mire and dirt. Usually during the pastor's stay at Mentone, there was at least one great storm, either far out at sea or near at hand. In 1882, in one of his letters home, he wrote the following graphic description of the scene he had just witnessed. Quote, "This afternoon I have been out to watch the sea. There was a storm last night, and the sea cannot forgive the rude winds, so it is avenging its wrongs upon the shore. Now, the sun shone at 3 o'clock, and there was no wind here. But away over the waters hung an awful cloud, and to our left a rainbow adorned another frowning mass of blackness. Now, though much mud was underfoot, all the world turned out to watch the hungry billows rush upon the beach. In one place they rolled against the esplanade and then rose, like the waterworks at Versailles, high into the air, over the walk, and across the road, making people run and dodge and leaving thousands of pebbles on the pavement. In another place the sea removed all the foreshore, undermined the walls, carried them away, and then assailed the broad path, which it destroyed in mouthfuls, such as a rustic eats bread and butter. Here and there it took away the curb. I saw some 12 feet of it go, and then it attacked the road. It was amusing to see the people move as a specially big wave dashed up. The lamp posts were going, and when I came in, and an erection of solid stone used as the site of a pump was on the move. Numbers of people were around this as I came in at sundown. It was undermined, and a chasm was opening between it and the road. Men were getting up the gas pipes or digging into the road to cut the gas off. I should not wonder if the road is partly gone by morning. Though splashed with mud, I could not resist the delight of seeing the huge waves and the seabirds flashing among them like soft lightnings. The deep sigh, the stern howl, the solemn hush, the booming roar, and the hollow mutter of the ocean were terrible and grand to me. Then the rosy haze of the far ascending spray and the imperial purple and azure of the more distant part of the waters, together with the snow-white manes of certain breakers on a line of rock, made up a spectacle never to be forgotten. Far away in the east, I saw just a few yards of rainbow standing on the sea. It seemed like a pharos glimmering there, or a ship in gala array, dressed out with the flags of all nations. Oh, God, how glorious art thou! I love thee the better for being so great, and so terrible, so good, so true. This God is our God, forever and ever." Another phenomenon was thus described in a letter of the same period. Quote, "About 6 in the evening, we were all called out into the road to see a superb aurora borealis, a sight that is very rarely seen here. Natives say that it is 12 years since the last appearance, and that it means a cold winter which will drive people to Mentone. Our mountains are to the north, and yet above their tops we saw the red glare of this wonderful visitant." Well, Mr. Spurgeon had been at Mentone so many years that he had watched its growth from little more than a village to a town of considerable size. He had so thoroughly explored it that he knew every nook and cranny, and there was not a walk or drive in the neighborhood with which he was not perfectly familiar. At the Hotel d'Italie, the pastor called to see John Bright, who was just then in anything but a bright frame of mind. He was in a very uncomfortable room, and was full of complaints of the variations in temperature in the sunshine and in the shade. His visitor tried to give him a description of Mentone, as he had known it for many years, but the great tribune of the people seemed only anxious to get away to more congenial quarters. Now, the Earl of Shaftesbury was another of the notable Mentone visitors, whom the pastor tried to cheer when he was depressed about the state of religious and social affairs in England and on the continent. One morning, among the little company gathered for family prayer, Mr. T.A. Denny unexpectedly put in an appearance. In explanation of his sudden arrival, he said, "I felt down in the dumps, so I thought I'd just run over to my friend Spurgeon for a few days, for it always does me good to see and hear him. His presence was equally welcome to the pastor, and they drove together to some of the most charming places in the district. In the earlier years of visiting Mentone, the pastor stayed at the Hotel des Anglais, and he used often to say that he never passed that spot without looking at a certain room and thanking God for the merciful deliverance which he there experienced. One day he was lying in that room very ill, but he had insisted upon the friends who were with him going out for a little exercise. Scarcely had they left when a madman, who had eluded the vigilance of his keepers, rushed in and said, "I want you to save my soul." With great presence of mind, the dear sufferer bade the poor fellow kneel down by the side of the bed and prayed for him, as best as he could under the circumstances. Mr. Spurgeon then told him to go away and return in half an hour. And providentially, he obeyed, and as soon as he was gone, the doctor and servants were summoned, but they were not able to overtake the madman before he had stabbed someone in the street. And only a very few days later, he met with a very terribly tragic end. It was while staying at the Hotel des Anglais that the pastor adopted a very original method of vindicating one of the two Christian ordinances which were always very dear to him. At a social gathering at which Mr. Spurgeon and a large number of friends were present, Mr. Edward Jenkins, a member of Parliament, the author of Jinx's Baby, persistently ridiculed believers' baptism. It was a matter of surprise to many that he did not at once to get the answer that he might have been sure he would receive sooner or later. The party broke up, however, without anything having been said by the pastor upon the question, but it was arranged that the next day all of them should visit Ventimiglia. On reaching the cathedral, Mr. Spurgeon led the way to the baptistry in the crypt, and when all the company had gathered round the old man who was explaining the objects of interest, the pastor said to his anti-immersionist friend, "Mr. Jenkins, you understand Italian better than we do. Will you kindly interpret for us what the guide is saying?" And thus fairly trapped, the assailant of the previous evening began, "This is an ancient baptistry. He says that in the early Christian church, baptism was always administered by immersion." The crypt at once rang with laughter, in which the interpreter joined as heartily as anyone, admitting that he had been as nearly soulless a man. Well, could be. Spurgeon had trapped him. Well, Mr. Spurgeon was never able to accept the invitation of a Mr. Hanbury, who wished him to stay at the Palazzo Orengo, but on two occasions he was the guest of Mrs. Dudgeon at the Villa Le Grotes. He had frequently spent a day there or gone to a drawing-room meeting in aid of one or other of the many works there, but on one of these occasions there were so many Church of England canons in the company that Mr. Spurgeon humorously said they might form a park of artillery. After a season of general conversation, the whole company usually settled down to listen to the story of the Stockwell Orphanage. When the weather permitted, Mrs. Dudgeon liked to arrange for a picnic at which other friends could have the opportunity of meeting her honored guest, and she related to him with great glee the remark of a Mentonese woman, a person from Mentone, concerning one of those outings. Quote, "I can't make out you English people at all. You have nice hotels and houses where you can have your meals in comfort, and yet you go and eat your dinner in a ditch." The ditch was, of course, a dry one, and usually an olive garden was the scene of the al fresco repast. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to move on to the next chapter. Let's move on and see what happens there. This is In the Sunny South, the second chapter of it. On one of the visits to Mrs. Dudgeon, the pastor and his secretary were photographed in her garden by her nephew, and there's a reproduction of it right here. For several years, Mr. Spurgeon stayed at the Hotel Beau Rivage. As he generally had several companions or friends who wished to be near him, His party usually occupied a considerable portion of the small building, and the general arrangements were as homelike as possible, even to the ringing of a bell when it was time for family prayer. Not only were there guests in the house who desired to be present, but many came from other hotels and villas in the neighborhood, and felt well rewarded by the brief exposition of the scriptures and the prayer which followed it. Those of the company who were members of any Christian church asked permission to attend the Lord's Day afternoon communion service, and it frequently happened that the large sitting room was quite full, and the folding doors had to be thrown back so that some communicants might be in the room adjoining. On the Sabbath morning, the pastor usually worshiped with the Presbyterian friends at the Villa Le Grotte, occasionally giving an address before the observance of the Lord's Supper and sometimes taking the whole service. While it's scarcely possible to tell how many people were blessed under the semi-private ministry which Mr. Spurgeon was able to exercise during his holiday, he used at times to feel that the burden became almost too great to be borne, for it seemed as if all who were suffering from depression of spirit, whether living in Mentone, Nice, Cannes, Bordighera, or San Remo, all the towns around there, found him out and sought the relief which his sympathetic heart was ever ready to bestow. In one case, a poor soul, greatly in need of comfort, was marvelously helped by a brief conversation with him. And the pastor himself thus related the story, preaching in the tabernacle in 1883. He said, "Some years ago, I was away in the south of France. I had been very ill there, and was sitting in my room alone, for my friends had all gone down to the midday meal. All at once it struck me that I had something to do out of doors. I did not know what it was, but I walked out and I sat down on a seat. And there came and sat next to me on the seat a poor, pale, emaciated woman in the last stage of consumption. I believe that would be called tuberculosis today. And looking at me, she said, 'Oh, Mr. Spurgeon, I've read your sermons for years, and I've learned to trust the Savior. I know I cannot live long, but I am very sad as I think of it, for I am so afraid to die.' Well, then I knew why I had gone out there, and I began to try to cheer her. I found that it was very hard work. After a little conversation, I said to her, 'Then you would like to go to heaven, but not to die?' 'Yes, just so,' she answered. 'Well, how do you wish to go there? Would you like to ascend in a chariot of fire?' Well, that method had not occurred to her, but she answered, 'Oh, yes, oh, yes.' 'Well,' I said, 'suppose there should be, just around this corner, horses all on fire and a blazing chariot waiting there to take you up to heaven. Do you feel ready to step into such a chariot?' Well, she looked up at me and she said, 'No, I should be afraid to do that.' 'Ah, and so should I. I should tremble a great more at getting into a chariot of fire than I would at dying. Now, I'm not fond of being behind fiery horses. I would rather be excused from taking such a ride as that.' And then I said to her, 'Let me tell you what will probably happen to you. You will most likely go to bed some night, and you'll wake up in heaven.' Well, that's just what did occur not long after. Her husband wrote to tell me that after our conversation, she had never had any more trouble about dying. She felt that it was the easiest way into heaven after all, far better than going there in a whirlwind with horses of fire and chariots of fire, and she gave herself up for her heavenly Father to take her home in his own way. And so she passed away, as I expected, in her sleep." The testimony of one American minister is probably typical of that of many others who came under Mr. Spurgeon's influence at Mentone. In one of his letters to the Chicago Standard, a Reverend Geiswick wrote, "It has been said that to know a man you must live with him. For 2 months, every morning, I found myself in Mr. Spurgeon's sitting room, facing the sea, with the friends who had gathered there for the reading of the Word and prayer. To me, it is far sweeter to recall those little meetings than to think of him merely as the great preacher of the tabernacle. Multitudes heard him there, while but few had the peculiar privilege accorded to me. His solicitude for others constantly shone out. An incident and illustration of this fact will never be forgotten by me. He had been very ill for a week, during which time, although I went daily to his hotel, he did not leave his bed. He could not be seen. His suffering was excruciating. A little later, I was walking in the street one morning, and he spied me from his carriage. He hailed me, and when I approached him, he held out his left hand and said cheerily, "Oh, you are worth 5 shillings a pound more than when I saw you last." And letting his voice fall to a tone of deep earnestness, he added, "Spend it all for the Lord." Well, a gentleman who was staying in the hotel at Mentone, where the pastor spent the winter of 1883, wrote, "As an instance of the rapidity of Mr. Spurgeon's preparation, the following incident may be given. There came to him from London a huge parcel of Christmas and New Year's cards. These were shown to some of the residents at the hotel, and a lady of our party was requested to choose one from them. The card she selected was a scriptural one. It was headed, 'The New Year's Guest.' And in harmony with the idea of hospitality, two texts were linked together. 'I was a stranger, and you took me in,' and 'As many as received him, to them he gave power to become sons of God, even to them that believe on his name.' The card was taken away by the lady, but on the following Lord's Day, after lunch, Mr. Spurgeon requested that it might be lent to him for a short time. The same afternoon, a service was held in his private room, and he then gave a most beautiful and impressive address upon the text on the card. The sermonette was printed in the Metropolitan Tabernacle pulpit shortly after that date, and has always seemed to me a wonderful illustration of Mr. Spurgeon's great power. Later in the day, he showed me the notes he had made in the half hour which elapsed between the time the card came into his possession and the service at which the address was delivered. And these, written on a half sheet of notepaper, consisted of the two main divisions, each one with several subdivisions, exactly as they appear in the printed address." Well, just as this chapter was being compiled, one of our own men, that is, Pastor Tompkins, thus reported a far more remarkable instance of the rapidity of Mr. Spurgeon's preparation. He said, quote, "One Thursday evening, during the time I was a student in the college, the dear president had been preaching in the west of England, at Bristol, I think, and by some cause was delayed on his way back to London. At the commencement of the service, Mr. James Spurgeon announced that he had received a telegram from his brother, mentioning the delay and stating that he would arrive in time to preach. During the reading of the lesson, which was the first chapter of the second epistle to Timothy, the great preacher entered, to the intense delight of the large congregation present. Mr. James Spurgeon was giving an exposition of the chapter when his brother, who had quietly taken a seat behind him, intimated his presence by gently pulling his coattail. The reading was soon finished, prayer was offered, and a hymn sung, and the text was announced, 'Wherefore I put thee in remembrance, that thou stir up the gift of God which is in thee by the putting on of my hands.'" Well, after an interesting and instructive introduction, the pastor proceeded to deliver a most orderly and helpful discourse, which seemed to bear the marks of careful preparation. But it was with astonishment we heard him say in the college the next day that the whole sermon of the previous evening flashed across his mind while sitting upon the platform during the reading of the chapter by his brother. Incredible. Well, we have to move ahead a little bit again. And the atmosphere at Mentone was so favorable for photographers' work that many portraits were taken there, and I do wish I could share those with you. You'll have to go to the Puritan hard drive, puritandownloads.com, and order your own copy, although this book will not help you. In fact, you might have to go elsewhere to find a copy of this book. I'm not sure where it's available, so that you can get pictures that actually you can see. I cannot see his face on any of these. Well, the sunshine and clear air at Mentone helped to increase the natural buoyancy of Mr. Spurgeon's spirits, and so provided a large supply of pure fun for all who were there with him. Walking by the seashore, at a time when the Mediterranean was raging furiously, he asked, "What are the wild waves saying?" Then gave his own witty answer to the question, "Let us spray. Let us pray. He's always, not always, but occasionally trying to be funny. On the sad occasion when he fell down a marble staircase, he did not at first realize how seriously he had been hurt. And having turned a double somersault, in the course of which some money fell from his pocket into his Wellington boots, and having also lost a tooth or teeth in his descent, he humorously described the whole transaction as painless dentistry, with money to boot. Oh, so that's where the words painless dentistry came from. And one of the most amusing incidents at Mentone was associated with the lions represented in this illustration. When Dr. Hanna was driving past these gates where the lions are, Mr. Spurgeon most seriously assured him that neither our own zoo nor the one at Paris possessed a specimen of the species of lion to which these belonged. And the worthy doctor accepted the information with the utmost gravity. And it was not until he awoke in the middle of the night that he saw the meaning of his genial companion's playful remark. And the next day, when they met, the conversation naturally turned upon the necessity of a surgical operation in order to get an Englishman's joke into a Scotchman's head. Okay. Well, let's see. We've got him writing now. I have a whole poem that he writes here, 6-8 verses, while he's there at Mentone, many other things he did there we just can't go into. We've come to the end of the chapter. Two chapters. I'm sorry that I have to skip so much, but I think it's wise that we move on as quickly as possible. We're over halfway through the final volume of the autobiography. The next one is entitled, and we'll come here next time, Unabated Affection Between Pastor and People. That one should be interesting. Well, God bless you. This is the Hackberry House of Chosun. Lord willing, again, we'll talk again very soon. Bye-bye.